During our opening statement, we told you what we believe the evidence would show. We told you that Officer Pettis used deadly force in order to protect another officer, Officer Scott Weimerskirch, from an immediate threat of serious bodily harm to prevent him from being stabbed by knives. Now, in presenting our opening statement to you, it was more than just words. It was a promise. It was a promise about what the evidence would show. And I believe now that we have completed the evidence we were here to present, we have fulfilled that promise to you. That Officer Pettis' shooting was justified. Now, the state has the burden of proof, and that can never be overstated. The state is here arguing that Mr. Boyd did not pose an immediate threat of serious bodily harm to Officer Weimerskirch. They must prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, because my client, Officer Dominique Pettis, is presumed innocent. And what I think that you must consider is that the state, not Officer Pettis, has to prove that the shooting was unreasonable. The state has to prove that. In fact, as you know, we did not have a burden whatsoever. We could have simply presented no evidence, and the state still had the same burden. But instead, what we did is we presented to you a very detailed case, as I said in my opening, about what actually happened. And I think with that detailed case, you now have all the evidence that you need in order to understand the challenge that lies ahead of you when you return to the jury room. So for me, the closing argument is really a review of the evidence. But as it turns out, it also has to be a review of argument. The state's argument and the things that they have said, not only throughout this entire case, but in closing as well. Now, what has the state argued to you that, as I will explain, doesn't matter? The state has argued to you that when the initial open space officers arrived, Officers McDaniel and Officers Hernandez, that they unnecessarily escalated the confrontation with James Boyd by drawing their weapons and confronting James Boyd at gunpoint. They also argue to you that Officer Monette, the CIT officer who was negotiating with Mr. Boyd, was prematurely taken away from the scene. They also argue to you that when Sergeant Jason Carpenter was there, he should have made it a SWAT call because all the criteria was there. So the state also argued to you that the arrest team and their plan was flawed. They argued to you that less lethal should have been brought up before deadly force was used. There's a problem with those arguments, and as I understand it, is state-created confusion. And there's a simple reason for this confusion, is that there's a lack of evidence as to the crimes that are actually being charged. Confusion is necessary when you don't have an argument that can convince you that the crimes actually occurred. And this is a simple, and again, there's a simple remedy for that if you're wondering, how do I deal with the confusion the state has proposed? And that is, should Officer Dominique Pettis be held responsible for the alleged mistakes of others? There's a thing called personal responsibility, and then unless you're in a supervisory or command position, are you responsible for what others do? Not the things you do, but what others do. And where we receive a bit of information that I think is very helpful is from the jury instructions, and I have three of them in my hand. Instruction number 16. You will receive that instruction, so again, you can verify that these are the rules by which you are to judge this case. And one of those rules, instruction number 16, is the availability of less lethal tools at the scene is not relevant to your determination of whether the elements of justifiable homicide by public officer or employee has been met. So there's been argument by the state that there were three beanbag shotguns there available for the arrest team to use, but they didn't use them. You saw the video of Officer Ramon Ornales running up to and was approximately 30 seconds away with a beanbag shotgun when the shooting happened. You might think to yourself, well, that's important. They could have waited. But what your instructions tell you is that it's not relevant. That is not a fact that you are to consider. So although the state persuasively argued that you should consider it, there are the court's rules that say do not.
It relates specifically to the elements of justifiable homicide by a public officer or employee.
Okay,
there's instruction number 18. Whether the actions of the person being defended played a role in creating the need to use force is not relevant to your determination of whether the elements of justifiable homicide by a public officer or the elements of justified homicide in defense of another have been met. Of course, whether the actions of the person being defended played a role in creating the need to use force is not relevant to your determination. How does that apply? A lot of criticism has been heaped on Officer Scott Weinerstrich. He's the officer, the canine officer, who got too close to Mr. Boyd. And again, the state has pointed out, the experts have pointed out, that's a problem. He created a dangerous situation for himself that required other officers to use deadly force to protect him. So, Officer Weinerstrich made a mistake. But is that the kind of mistake that you're going to hold Officer Pettis responsible for? Again, what is the evidence here that Officer Pettis say or do anything that caused Officer Weinerstrich to close the distance? And if you ask yourself that question, you will know there is none. And again, that whole thing, are you going to hold Officer Pettis accountable for the mistakes of others? This instruction says that you should not. You are barred from considering the mistake made by Officer Weinerstrich in determining whether Officer Pettis did what he was allowed to do in using deadly force. There's instruction 22. The defendants cannot be held responsible for the independent decisions and actions of another officer. You shall disregard any witness opinion to the contrary. This is an instruction. So I gave you a laundry list of claims the state made about the mistakes made by others. The open space officers, Sergeant Carpenter, you know, the failure to allow Officer Monet to continue his negotiations, the tactics of the arrest team. I can go on. But in the end, it does not matter to the determination of the guilt of Officer Pettis for the decisions and actions he took. So that you heard the very impassioned and convicted argument by Ms. McGinn that those things should matter to you. But those instructions now tell you that they don't. So don't be lured into thinking just because the prosecutor was persuasive that you should act on that. Instead, you must follow your instructions to ensure that my client, as well as Detective Sandy, receive a fair trial, that they are judged by the rule of law, as opposed by the conviction of this prosecutor. Now, there was a certain amount of testimony about 20/20 hindsight, and you might recall that I asked Mr. Noble, the state's police procedures expert, three questions that I think are very important to what it is that you're doing here. The first one, do you agree that hindsight is not only clearer than perception in the moment, but also unfair to those who actually live through the moment? You might recall me asking Mr. Noble that question. You might also recall me asking Mr. Noble this question as well. Do you agree that reality looks much more obvious in hindsight than in foresight? And finally, I asked Mr. Noble,
Do you agree that hindsight makes past events seem more predictable than was actually the case? Now, Mr. Noble hemmed and hawed, because you know what? Life experience and common sense tells us that there's something intrinsically wrong in judging others with hindsight. And embedded in those questions are the life lessons that all of us have learned, that hindsight is not only clear in perception in the moment, but is also unfair to those who actually live through the moment. You can be second-guessed, and it doesn't matter who you are. You don't have to be a police officer. To be second-guessed is not to be appropriately judged. Because in order to be appropriately judged, you have to understand that that person can only know what he knows in the moment, that they're only armed with foresight, and foresight is limited. Hindsight, because you know how it turned out, gives you the luxury to consider what could have been. But when you're looking at it at the moment, you don't have that luxury. So the state has engaged in a very calculated effort to use hindsight to have you second guess everything that has happened. But at the end of the day, your instructions will tell you that you have to view this at the moment that these officers had to make these life and death decisions, that that's the only appropriate way in which to do that. And I should also say this, because I think this is abundantly true, especially in this case. Hindsight makes past events seem more predictable than was actually the case. You now know what happened. In fact, you've spent almost 3 weeks thinking about what happened. But these officers did not have that luxury. And I sincerely mean that, luxury, the luxury of time. So as you go into your deliberations, I want you to consider that. I want you to think about Mr. Noble and how he defied common sense, and he wants you to second-guess someone. And again, you can simply consider yourself lucky to have 3 weeks to consider life or death decisions. But these officers did not. Now, was Mr. Boyd surrendered? Again, the problem with many of the state's arguments is that although they can be persuasively presented by their attorneys, they run into some very stubborn facts. Again, Ms. McGinn explained to you, as she did in her opening and she did in her closing, that what Mr. Boyd was doing when he began to turn is he was turning to go to the ground. And that seems sort of strange initially, I'm sure. You think, why do you need to turn to go to the ground? That's the state's argument. But the problem with that argument is that if you think, if Mr. Boyd's going to the ground, why doesn't he go down to the ground in front of him? That only seems to make sense, doesn't it? And when you actually look at the evidence, what you'll be struck with is this. Now, I'm showing you a frame from the video. And what I want you to note, and I'm using my cursor to indicate as much, is Mr. Boyd's black and blue backpack. That's what he had on his person as he attempted to walk down the mountain. It's there. It's not a fact. It's in controversy. We move to the next frame. That's frame 136. The flashbang is deployed. Mr. Boyd has his backpack in his hand, and he's throwing it down. And the way that Detective Sandy explained it has forever sort of just stuck with me. He threw down his belongings like a hockey player who's about to start a fight. And that really struck me because that's the manner in which Mr. Boyd released both bags from his hands. And again, look at that backpack because it will matter as we go through this analysis. Gravity, of course, takes the backpack to the ground, and there it is. We know where it landed before Mr. Boyd was shot. Now, this is frame 148. I'm going to use this frame, 148, in this comparison. Frame 148 has the backpack next to Mr. Boyd's feet, And you can now see the backpack in this exhibit, which is exhibit E28. That's Mr. Boyd's backpack. So I'm using the cursor right now to indicate the area where Mr. Boyd was standing when the officer-involved shooting occurred. And what do you see in front of Mr. Boyd? If Mr. Boyd was really going to the ground, there was ground in front of him in which he could surrender. But instead, the state makes a very strange argument that he was turning around to surrender. And again, doesn't that defy common sense? Again, I want you to think about this. Here is a picture that shows you, and it's uncontroverted, that Mr. Boyd had the opportunity, had the availability of open space for him to go to the ground in front of him. But that's not what he did. And of course, we'll continue to talk about Mr. Boyd's alleged surrender throughout this closing argument, but I want you to think about that. And you think about proof beyond a reasonable doubt. They're telling you Mr. Boyd was surrendering, but what does this tell you about whether that's true? Just to be crystal clear about that point. The state also argued to you that Mr. Boyd was not an immediate threat. But once again, that argument runs into some very stubborn facts. Now, you remember Mr. Noble, the state's expert, police procedures expert, and you might recall a series of questions that I asked Mr. Noble. And I'll read them to you for just to be clear. The question I asked Mr. Noble, and I asked him, I think it was three questions, and he gave three answers. Question: you would agree with me that Mr. Boyd, armed with knives, had the means to kill officers if that is what he was allowed to do. Answer by Mr. Noble: he had the means. Question by me: okay. And because of the distance between Mr. Boyd and Officer Weimerskirch, who was unarmed, the opportunity presented itself for Mr. Boyd to stab Officer Weimerskirch. Mr. Noble's answer: it was only an opportunity if the immediacy evolved, if there was some sort of movement or attack that was initiated. I asked him another question. So, would you agree with me that if I show you the video and I showed you the step, that would be enough to prove that the opportunity was there? Continuing with Mr. Noble's testimony. Answer: I've seen the video. If indeed Mr. Boyd took a step or a lunge towards the officers, then the officers' use of deadly force would have been justified. So what I'm going to show you is a series of frames from the video. And what I've done is I've looped those frames. So you will see the essential step four times. But I'm doing that to emphasize something to you. And that is the phantom step is a real step, and it's here in the video. So again, I'm going to play it. You'll see the frame sort of march forward. You'll see a loop. It'll be another loop of the video, and you'll see it four times. There's no phantom there. That is a step. Even the state's own expert understands that that would be the initiation of an attack. And given those distances, Mr. Boyd could accomplish that attack very quickly. And in order to stop that attack from occurring, deadly force was required. There is no phantom in that video. You saw it. Now, Ms. McGinn played to you a video taken by Mr. Thixton from another perspective. The problem with that video is that there was a rock shell, a giant granite boulder, that obscured Mr. Boyd's legs. So when you play the Thixton video, you can only see from essentially the waist up. You can't see Mr. Boyd's legs. And that's a problem. If you're going to use that video to prove a step wasn't taken, that's one thing. But when you have the video of actually that shows Mr. Boyd's legs, there is a problem. And that problem is this, that the thick-skin video does not prove that there wasn't a stab. Because why? We have better evidence taken from a much closer vantage point by a camera that was positioned in the way to actually show Mr. Boyd's legs. Again, we're talking reasonable doubt here. You may think he didn't really actually take a step. Mr. Thickskin's video seems to indicate that there wasn't much movement. But for an officer who's facing Mr. Boyd and sees that, there you have it. Immediacy exists and is here, proof positive in this video. Now, Ms. McGinn also talked to you about the fact that neither of these officers saw the step. And that makes a certain amount of sense. You take the weapon, you bring it up, and what do you see? You see the sighting system, you see all the components that make the weapon. You can't see below it because something is obscuring your vision, the weapon that you have up to you so that you can shoot. If these officers had said, I could see his legs, that would be a problem because they would be untruthful. That is, something's in front of their face, obscuring what they can see below, and now they're saying they can see it. But instead, they're being honest with you. They can't see a step because something is in the way. And that should give you a bit of understanding as to credibility. The state wants to use it, misuse that fact. But what does that fact really say about these officers? That they're telling you the truth. Here is a fact that would help exonerate them. But they don't testify to it because they didn't see it. That's honesty. And that's something you should consider. When you're thinking about whether these officers are credible, think about the opportunity not to tell the truth. Be kind of enticing to look at this video and say, look, I saw the step and that's why I fired. But they didn't. Instead, they did what was right. They only testified as to what they could see. State would have it much differently. But then again, all they are armed with is arguments. They don't have evidence. And again, it's not argument that should win cases. It's evidence that should ultimately be the basis upon which you decide this case. Officer Pettis made the decision to shoot when Mr. Boyd was not an immediate threat. That is an argument which Ms. McGinn presented to you in her opening and an argument she presented to you in a closing. Again, there are facts that make that argument hollow. Now, Mr. Noble, once again, helps us understand how you determine how an officer's use of deadly force should be judged. I asked Mr. Noble, question, I'd like to focus your attention, Mr. Noble, to Officer Pettis' use of deadly force. Now, you would agree that your analysis of whether Officer Pettis' use of force was objectively reasonable focuses on the moment that Officer Pettis made the decision to use deadly force. His answer was yes. I asked him another question. Would you agree that at the moment analysis is appropriate for Officer Pettis' decision? Answer, for Officer Pettis, yes. Then I asked him a final question. Now, at the moment analysis focuses on the moment that Officer Pettis made the decision to pull the trigger of his weapon. The answer was yes. So what does that mean? You don't judge, according to Mr. Noble, the state's own expert, you don't judge someone by where the bullet lands. You judge an officer at the moment the decision is made. Two very different things. And what we've learned now is that they're also separated in time. You judge an officer with regards to their decision, not how it actually turns out. And what do we know about Officer Pettis' decision? Once again, that's all in the video.
It's all right there if you only know what to look for. Mr. Noble told you, you make a determination
as to whether the use of deadly force was justified by determining whether at the moment the decision was made, it was justified. So again, Mr. Boyd arming himself with knives. And how do we know from this video when Officer Pettis made his decision? Well, we know when he made the decision. Well, we know he took an action. And that is to move his finger, wrong hand, move his finger from the receiver or the basically the side of the weapon to the trigger. That what had to precede it was a decision to use deadly force. Because all of these officers were trained that you don't put your trigger until you're ready to shoot your target. You keep your trigger finger off the trigger until that time. So what is that, or how does that look? Well, once again, I've created a loop from the helmet camera video, and I want you to focus, and because it's a loop, you'll have the opportunity to look at Officer Pettis' index finger, his trigger finger, and look at what Mr. Boyd is doing. You'll see the trigger finger moves after Mr. Boyd has his hands out with the knives brandished. Mr. Boyd takes that step, brandishes, or essentially challenges the officers with his knives, and that's when the finger goes from the receiver to the trigger. That's the decision in action. That's how you know when the decision was made. And what do we know from the state's own expert? That's how you judge Officer Pettis' use of deadly force. So, see for yourself, what was Mr. Boyd doing when the decision was made? Mr. Boyd was posing an immediate threat of serious bodily harm to the officers. That's what he was doing at the moment Officer Pettis made his decision. Another argument that basically came out throughout these proceedings is this whole idea that more and better resources should have been sent to the standoff with Mr. Boyd. And that's part of the confusion you have here. This isn't a trial about the Albuquerque Police Department and how it responds to situations involving individuals with mental illness. It's not the city of Albuquerque that's being held responsible for its decisions on how resources are allocated. What you have here are two officers who are basically captives of the decisions of others, of how resources are allocated to situations such as this. And what do I mean by that? One of the things, and you might recall, I asked Mr. Noble, their expert, and he agreed. He said that society has made police officers into the social workers and mental health workers of last resort. Those are decisions that are made by our elected officials about how we, as a community, deal with the mentally ill. These officers did not decide that. They essentially have to, of course, suffer the consequences of decisions made by elected officials not to allocate sufficient resources to the mentally ill. Why was Mr. Boyd up there? That's actually a question you ought to consider. It wasn't because Officer Pettis put him up there. So when you think about the resolution of this case, and you think about what these officers could bring to this situation, what was that? They brought three trained CIT officers. You heard about Officer Monette and his efforts to try and work with Mr. Boyd. Officer Niprath, who did not negotiate with Mr. Boyd, was there as Officer Monet negotiated. He was there, could have been used. And you had a supervisor, Sergeant Jason Carpenter, who was also CIT trained. You might recall that Sergeant Carpenter was a medic in the Army. After he, essentially left the Army, he worked in the psych ward, I think that's the word he used, the psych ward of the VA hospital. This is someone who has real-world experience working with the mentally ill. He was there as a supervisor. And what did he tell you? Because that's really important. Officer, like anyone else, you think you can do anything. But then someone looking back objectively at a distance, observing you, might see things very differently. So you had a CIT-trained supervisor, Sergeant Carpenter, who had actually worked with the mentally ill, watching Officer Monet's interactions with Mr. Boyd. And what did he conclude? This was his testimony, not my summation of it. Sergeant Carpenter told you that Officer Monet was doing a good job, but he wasn't making progress. Wasn't making progress with Mr. Boyd. And remember why he ultimately decided that Officer Monet should be pulled off altogether? That once the state police officer arrived, and that was Sergeant Bankston, Officer Monet was not talking to Mr. Boyd. Essentially, in his own mind, I'm sure, Officer Monet thought he could fix things. But what did a supervisor who was better trained think about that? It wasn't working. That's why he was comfortable with having Officer Monet being moved off the mountain and no longer negotiating with Mr. Boyd. Now, there's also a concern that was raised in the way that questions were asked, that the training that you heard about was calculated basically to create conflict instead of diffusing conflicts. But again, the facts are very stubborn things, and what do I mean by that? You heard Daniel Kafferke, he was the commander of the academy, talk to you about how basically the state pushes down on the various agencies throughout the state the training that they are to use. So the state is in charge of use of force, the state is in charge of the crisis management training that officers give, that APD and every other police department doesn't have much say as to what is taught. That's what we learned from Daniel Kafferke. And what did we learn from Sergeant Johnston? That the use of force curriculum was to prescribe, or that is, that's what the state required you as the Albuquerque Police Department to give to its cadets. And you may think to yourself, well, I don't know if I'm very comfortable with that use of force curriculum. And again, that's what these officers were taught. This is the use of force methodology that they were taught. And again, in your professional lives, I'm sure you think to yourself that, you know, there are limits to the methodologies and the resources, the technologies that are available to you. 10 years from now, resources, the technology, the methodologies available to you, you know, make you think back, I don't know why I did things the way I did 10 years ago. But what we have here is we have officers who are being trained under the state-prescribed curriculum, and they're doing things the way they were taught with the resources they were given. There's also this whole idea of theoretical availability and practical availability. If we had unlimited resources, we could do unlimited things. That's theoretical. The practical reality is that all of those things that some of you think maybe would have made a difference weren't practical because they weren't available. These officers work within the constraints forced upon them in terms of resources, technologies, and methodology. There is nothing that they can do other than to work within the system in which they were a part. So to hold these officers responsible for things that they cannot control is also something that the jury instructions tell you that you should not do. So if you think to yourself, you know what? I don't really like this training. I don't really like the way that the mentally ill are handled in Albuquerque or the way officers are taught to deal with them. That's one thing. But to hold these officers responsible for something they did not have a role in deciding is wrong. And I would ask you to honor the court's instructions and not go down that path that the state is asking you to go. Now, Mr. Boyd posed an immediate threat of serious physical harm to Officer Weimerskirch. And we have the three jury instructions that I want you to think about and focus on, because that are the rules by which you must decide this case. Now, instruction number 12 is the instruction that deals with second-degree murder. And really, as Ms. McGinn highlighted in her presentation, number 3 is the element that matters most. And that is that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Officer Pettis did not act in defense of another or because there are two defenses, or Officer Pettis did not commit a justifiable, homicide by a public officer or employee, or act in defense of another. So we have two defenses, and we'll talk about them because they're two separate instructions. The state has to disprove, that is, prove that there are no facts to support those defenses. And those defenses are, and we go to instruction number 17. Now, instruction number 17 is defense of another. That Officer Pettis used deadly force in defense of another, and that is a defense, that is an affirmative defense, to the charge of second-degree murder. So there was an and this is number one, there was an appearance of immediate danger or death, or great bodily harm to another officer as a result of James Boyd removing his knives from his pocket during the execution of an arrest plan. The second element, the defendant believed that another officer was in immediate danger of death or great bodily harm from James Boyd and killed James Boyd to prevent death or great bodily harm. And that danger, and that's number three, the apparent danger to that other officer would have caused a reasonable person in the same circumstances to act as defendant did. Those are elements that the state must prove beyond the reasonable doubt. Officer Pettis does not have to prove that his shooting was justified. That's why he's presumed innocent. So I want you to understand that at the most fundamental level, we didn't have to put on any evidence, even though we did. The state has to prove this to you beyond the reasonable doubt. This is instruction number 15, and this is an instruction for the defense of justifiable homicide by a law enforcement officer. And number one, I think that's already proven, the defendant, Officer Pettis, was a public officer employee. He was an APD officer. Number two, the killing was committed while the defendant was performing his duties as a public officer or employee. He was on call 24/7, so he was activated by Sergeant Fox. He was on the job. As for number three, the killing was committed while overcoming the actual resistance of James Boyd to the discharge of the legal duty to arrest James Boyd for the felony crime of aggravated assault on a peace officer. So the state has characterized Officer Sandy, Detective Sandy, Officer Weimerskirch, and Sergeant Ingram as an arrest team. And yet they argue they weren't there to arrest him, even though their characterization is that they are three individuals who are there to arrest Mr. Boyd. Then there's this whole notion that you have to tell a suspect that they are under arrest before putting them under arrest. That's Hollywood. You don't actually have to tell someone that they're under arrest before they're actually arrested. Remember what Officer Pettis said when I asked him about that. It's when someone is not free to go, that's when they're under arrest. Just telling someone they're under arrest, did you actually hear Mr. Noble say that that's how they do it in California? Or anyone else, Detective Stone, who is the person who's most knowledgeable in this case, that you have to tell someone they're under arrest for them to be under arrest? There's no jury instruction from the court that as a matter of law, you have to tell the suspect they're under arrest. Once again, there's no evidence. So what are you left with? The argument of the state. There is no evidence. Think about it. Is there anyone who suggested, Mr. Noble especially, or Jeff Stone, that you have to tell someone this before you can arrest them? The only one who suggested that was a person who cannot testify, and that's Ms. McGinn. So think about that, and also think about this. 19 officers had surrounded Mr. Boyd for 3.5 hours. Was he really free to leave? Would a reasonable person sitting in Mr. Boyd's shoes think to themselves, you know what, they're not here for me. They must be here for some other reason. So when Officer Pettis told you that someone's under arrest when they're not free to leave, that's exactly the position in which Mr. Boyd was in. He was not free to leave. Those 19 officers were not going to let him leave. And again, what did you hear from Sergeant Carpenter? We're going to take him into custody and take him to MDC, where As odd as it may sound for those of you who are not familiar with the criminal justice system, that the Metropolitan Detention Center actually provides the best mental health care for the indigent, and it's actually true. He was going to be arrested, and we know that from Sergeant Carpenter's testimony. It's just that they didn't want to escalate the situation by telling Mr. Boyd. It was one thing to tell him to put down his knives, but then to layer on top of that, we're going to arrest you, it would only make things worse. So again, take it for what it is. The argument of the state to trying to have you believe that what they do in Hollywood movies and television shows is actually what police officers do. Now, we talked an awful lot about the Albuquerque Police Department standard operating procedures regarding the use of force. Because when you go back into the jury room, one of the things you have to understand is these officers, with their training and the rules that they had to follow, did they act reasonably? And although the immediate threat, as articulated here, is not part of your jury instruction, it does help you understand how these officers are trained. How these officers are trained and what they're asked to look for. So when you look at immediacy, the thing I want to point out to you, and that's something that the state brought up in one of their very first slides, is that for Albuquerque Police Department officers, when they're trained about immediacy, and again, they're talking about the legal standards, the immediacy of the threat must be assessed with the legal standards, an articulable threat that currently exists or may happen within moments. So there is this notion that the attack is underway or the attack is about to occur with or without warning. The Albuquerque Police Department SOPs take this problem head on. Because as you know, and what these officers explain, is that you sometimes have to act in anticipation of an attack. Why? Because of the reactionary gap. And what was interesting about Ms. McGinn and what she said about James Fox is that he was on her side. And it struck me as odd, because I remember James Fox being the individual who brought up the reactionary gap and why you have to, in certain situations, have to act before the suspect acts. In order to stop an attack that once it gets underway, you will not have time to stop. That was what Sergeant James Fox testified to. I think you remember that. And again, what I hope you do is you don't necessarily rely on the attorneys to tell you what it is or what wasn't said. I think that I'm very clear, and I've always been very honest with all of you and very factual with you about what did and did not happen. Again, my opening was never contradicted in any way, unlike others. I presented to you the facts, simple, simple facts. And Sergeant James Fox, he's the one who first talked to you about this notion that sometimes in order to stop an attack, because it will happen so quickly, you have to act before it happens. And that was reinforced by officer after officer. Officer Dave Hubbard, who taught the Edge Weapons Awareness course, told you about that. And I think it's very important to also talk about this, the way that Ms. McGinn used the reactive control model. Do you remember how that model was used or how it was termed? And it was basically, I think it was Commander Caffrey. People learn in different ways. There's auditory learners, there's visual learners, there's kinesthetic learners. This is a learning tool, the reactive control model, for visual learners. Now, what did Sergeant Johnston provide you with? A lot of information about the 16 hours in which all of this information, all of the information that's provided to these cadets during their training. Ms. McGinn wants you to think that a learning tool for visual learners is the way in which Albuquerque Police Department officers are judged. But instead, and Sergeant Johnston, you know, I think provided you just as thorough an explanation as anyone else did, that closing the distance works both ways. What matters in the end is the proximity between the suspect and the officer, not how it happened. And again, one of the things you also learn, that in order to make an arrest, an officer has to make the conscious decision to close distance. Otherwise, you could never effect an arrest. Now, you heard Sergeant Johnson talk about that. You've heard all the other officers talk about it. But the state wants you to disregard all the testimony you've heard to focus on a learning tool that's only meant to help certain people learn a concept. But that concept, so, you know, again, the way the reactive control model presents it, disregards everything else that's taught. And you should not fall victim to this characterization of what the reactive control model is. It's not the standard operating procedures. The rules, the actual rules by which these officers are judged, they're not judged by a learning tool. They're judged by the standard operating procedures. They're judged, and the determination of immediate threat is judged through the SOP. Now, what about the facts? What about the facts? When the officers attempted to take Mr. Boyd in custody, they knew from Officer Hernandez and Officer McDaniel that when they approached him, Mr. Boyd drew knives and threatened to kill them. That constitutes the crime of aggravated assault. Now, that being said, Mr. Noble agreed that there was an aggravated assault. Detective Stone agreed there was an aggravated assault. Everyone, including the person who had the aggravated assault committed against him, Officer Hernandez, told you it happened. So the officers had the factual basis upon which to arrest Mr. Boyd. And you also learned from these officers that the simple fact that Mr. Boyd is mentally ill does not sort of, you know, prevent him from being arrested. Again, mental illness is dealt with within the criminal justice system after someone is taken into custody, not before. You wouldn't want an officer making decisions about someone's mental health. That's not appropriate. An officer should only act on the actions of the person who's arrested. And it's for the criminal justice system to make determinations about who should be held culpable or not. But what is clear, and what I believe the evidence overwhelmingly told you, is that that crime was committed and Mr. Boyd was to be arrested for it. Now, with regards to dropping the knives, I told you in the opening statement that Mr. Boyd was told 33 times. Mr. Noble agreed with that. Jeff Stone, the person who knew the most about it, agreed with that. There was no one who came in here and said that didn't happen. So that's true. He was given an opportunity, Mr. Boyd, to drop his knives, to surrender, but he never did. Now again, these are things that all the officers talked about. We know from the words Mr. Boyd said, the actions that he took, that he had the intent to cause serious bodily harm. That is true. And more importantly, that, if you think about what Ms. McGinn played for you and during Keith Sandy's cross-examination, she played for you the words that Mr. Boyd said before deadly force was used. If I was in a bar or in a bus stop, I could kill you right now. Words to that effect. Those were directed at Officer Weimerskirch. And again, we played for you videos that showed that Officer Weimerskirch had received threats of death before. But right before it all happened, Mr. Boyd was still threatening Officer Weimerskirch with death. Mr. Boyd had the means. Certainly he was armed. And as an able-bodied adult, he could act upon those means and deliver deadly force. An opportunity. Opportunity. Again, immediacy is really about opportunity. The state wants to make it into that Mr. Boyd was taking enough steps to constitute an attack. But as you heard from all of these officers, it's much more sublime and subtle than that. It's really about proximity. Proximity. Again, you heard Sergeant Johnson use the word proximity. You heard Sergeant Fox used the word proximity. You heard officer use that word. And somehow, when Officer Pettis uses it and Detective Sandy uses it, they're up to something. Maybe it's because that's how they were trained, that they use the words that they do. Common language among professionals. Again, to them it doesn't seem unusual because that's how they all talk. Maybe to Ms. McGinn it seems unusual, because she's not around police officers to know, is that they have their own distinct professional language. Proximity being one of those words that matters to law enforcement. So again, I think that that's one of those arguments that sort of like misses the point. That is, Proximity matters because it creates the opportunity. If someone is close enough, and again, I don't want to rehash the tool you drew. I don't want to rehash what's been hashed over and over again. But it's because you can't stop someone from initiating an attack if they're close enough. You have to act before the attack begins. And I'm going to say it until I'm blue in my face, and I know that there were witness after witness who said it until they were blue in the face. And so I want you to think about that when Ms. McGinn comes back up here and tells you the reactor control model is the only thing that matters, and there has to be an attack in motion in order for there to be immediacy. Now, the speed of light. You might recall that when I was conducting the redirect, it was the direct of Officer Pettis, I asked him a question. What was unfair about slicing the video into frame by frame review? And he used these words, the speed of life. You've been here 3 weeks listening to the lawyers argue, listening to the witnesses talk to you, showing you evidence, showing you photographs, showing you freeze frames, showing you loops, showing you all sorts of things. And that's wonderful, but that's not what Officer Pettis had the opportunity to do. He didn't have 3 weeks to think about the right thing to do. No. And that's where hindsight comes in. If you had 3 weeks to make a decision like that, maybe you would have made a different decision. But if you were given seconds, that's something different, very different. And what's the best way to understand that? And this is something that hasn't happened, I think, enough. And when Officer Pettis used those words, the speed of light, it occurred to me, you need to see one more time, because I think only once have you been showed the video from beginning to end, that this is actually what these officers had to work with. This is the amount of time they had to make decisions. And these are the tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving circumstances that they had to work with.
Do it.
Get on the ground!
Get on the ground!
Get on the ground now!
Get on the ground!
Get on the ground!
Don't make fun of people!
No 3 weeks for Officer Pettis. He had to make life and death decisions and moments. Now, with regard to the state's burden of proof, you've been given an instruction. The law presumes the defendants to be innocent unless and until you are satisfied beyond the reasonable doubt of the guilt of each of them. The burden is always on the state to prove guilt beyond the reasonable doubt. It is not required that the state prove guilt beyond all possible doubt. The test is one of reasonable doubt. A reasonable doubt is a doubt based upon reason and common sense, the kind of doubt that would make a reasonable person hesitate to act in the graver and more important affairs of life. Allow me to have you entertain a thought experiment, because the actual experiment I could never do, and my wife would never allow me to do. Consider, this is just a thought experiment, you bring a cat and a mouse, and you put them in a cardboard box. You seal up the cardboard box and come walk away and come back in an hour. You come back to this cardboard box, and there's only a cat. There's no more mouse. What happened to the mouse? Well, you didn't see what happened to the mouse. What you can reasonably conclude is that the cat ate the mouse. Another thought experiment. Bring that cat back with another mouse, put him in a cardboard box, close it up, go away for an hour and come back. Come back, open the box, look inside it, there's a cat, and there's a hole in the box. Did the cat eat the mouse, or did the mouse claw out a hole and get away? You weren't there to see it, but there are now two explanations. There are two explanations. There's a hole in the box that provides an alternative explanation. And that's reasonable doubt. There's another way of looking at the same facts. The state has to prove to you that there are no other alternative explanations. And what I hope the evidence has now shown you
is that the state's case is full of holes. And I would like to explore some of them. These are questions that you should ask yourself when you're in deliberations. What evidence has the state presented to you which shows that Mr. Boyd was peaceful and nonviolent? The state wants you to believe that Mr. Boyd was not an immediate threat of serious bodily harm to these officers. But what evidence, if any, have they shown you that he was a peaceful and nonviolent man? Instead, what evidence do you actually have? You have the history of Mr. Boyd as reported over the computer-aided dispatch and the radio. That Mr. Boyd has, he's been charged with, numerous aggravated assaults on law enforcement officers in various jurisdictions, including Albuquerque. So what do we know? What does that mean? We know from Detective Stone's testimony that Mr. Boyd has either used a deadly weapon or has caused great bodily harm on law enforcement officers. Not just Albuquerque Police Department officers, but we also know when he was housed at the Metropolitan Detention Center. That's what we know about Mr. Boyd's history. And then what do we know about him on that day? Were these officers ever given any evidence that Mr. Boyd was a peaceful, nonviolent man? No. And what has the state done to prove this? I submit to you, not much, if anything. What evidence has the state presented to you that would compel you to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Boyd was surrendering when he was falling on the ground? Now, I presented to you a series of photographs that called into question this whole notion that Mr. Boyd was turning around to surrender, when in fact there was plenty of room to surrender right in front of him. But what did you also hear in my opening statement? That Mr. Boyd's fall to the ground wasn't a decision he made. It was a consequence of him being shot. I think most of you, when you think about that, being shot would likely cause the kind of excruciating pain that would cause someone to fall to the ground. We never suggested that a bullet imparted enough energy, inertia, on someone to move them. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that the pain caused by the bullet causes people to react. And how do you know this? Dr. Sam Andrews, the pathologist, told you as much. That is a natural human reaction to essentially protect the internal organs, and that is to fall to the ground and cradle that injury. We know that from Sam Andrews. That was unrebutted. We know from Ron McCarthy that when people are shot, they turn away from the source of the bullets. That also makes a certain amount of sense, doesn't it? So when you go back and ask yourself, was Mr. Boyd surrendering, or is there another very real possibility about what was happening to Mr. Boyd? That is, he fell to the ground because of the pain of being shot by Detective Sandy. That's reasonable doubt. If Mr. Boyd was truly surrendering at the time the officers made the decision to shoot, why was Mr. Boyd's reaction upon being told to get on the ground was to draw and brandish his knives? So you might remember the sequence. And again, you can go back to the video and check out my sequence. Officer Pettis gave Mr. Boyd four commands to get on the ground. And after being given four opportunities to get on the ground, what did Mr. Boyd do? He drew his knives. Ms. McGinn tried to sort of spin it with Mr. Boyd. There's a reactionary gap for Mr. Boyd. Well, that might, I'm not disagreeing with that. But if you give Mr. Boyd the benefit of the doubt that he has a reactionary gap, how did Mr. Boyd react after he was given enough time to, after being told to put down or to get on the ground? He drew his knives. That's what he did in response to being told to get on the ground. He didn't get on the ground right away. Again, reasonable doubt is here. It is everywhere throughout this case. If Mr. Boyd was truly surrendering at the time the officers made the decision to shoot, why did Mr. Boyd refuse to surrender the knife? You heard Mr. McCarthy talk to you about what is surrender. What is surrender? And what did you learn? That is giving up your weapons, unequivocally, objectively showing that you're going to submit to custody. Mr. Boyd, after being shot, fell to the ground. He heard that from Detective Stone, and was still holding on to his knives. After being shot three times, Mr. Boyd held on to his knives. That's undisputed. And is that, in your mind, surrender? What outward objective expressions of surrender did Mr. Boyd display prior to the time Officer Pettis made the decision to fire? I went through that with Mr. Noble. I went through that with Detective Stone. What did Mr. Boyd say that an officer could rely upon to conclude that he was surrendering? What did Mr. Boyd do that an officer could rely upon dependably to find out that Mr. Boyd was surrendering? Mr. Boyd never said, "I give up." Mr. Boyd never said, "I'll stop, I surrender, I'll put down the knives." He never said anything like that. Mr. Boyd didn't put up his hands, the sort of universal act of surrender. Mr. Boyd never dropped the knives, never went down to his knees, never did anything to show that he was submitting. Instead, what the state wants you to believe, that if Mr. Boyd turned a step away from the officers, they should have known he was surrendering, even though the entire run of these 3.5 hours proved that Mr. Boyd was not going to do it. That quarter turn should have told these officers that everything Mr. Boyd had done in the past was now over. He was going to surrender. And how reasonable is that? Especially for these officers who, when they saw a canine officer approach Mr. Boyd with nothing in his hands other than a leash, Mr. Boyd took out his knives. How are these officers supposed to know that a quarter turn is surrender? Again, there is reasonable doubt everywhere in this case. What evidence did the state offer to rebut the testimony of the many witnesses who testified that Officer Pettis acted precisely as the Albuquerque Police Department use of force policy compelled him to do so in this situation? You may not be comfortable with how the Albuquerque Police Department standard operating procedures read. You may want immediacy to find a different way. But Officer Pettis didn't get the benefit of that. More importantly, Officer Pettis was held accountable for reacting and responding according to the SOP. So this whole notion about an anticipatory attack, that's what the SOP allowed. Let's just be real clear about that. That is what the Albuquerque Police Department expected of its officers. Same question, but with regard to training. You may not be comfortable with the training these officers received. You may think to yourself, you know, these officers should give the suspect a bigger benefit of the doubt. These officers shouldn't jump to the sort of conclusions that I heard from the witnesses who testified. But did you ever hear a witness say something about training that was given to Officer Pettis and think to yourself, Officer Pettis didn't do it? No. Instead, what you heard is that Officer Pettis, what he did and how he did it, was consistent with the training that he was given. And to hold someone responsible for doing the things the way the department requires them to do them, holding someone responsible for murder, for doing as they've been trained to do, is a bridge too far. Again, the state mandates the training these officers are supposed to receive, and yet you have the same state prosecuting them. If really the state...
Your Honor, objection is misleading, and I think also over time as well.
Let me have you approach.
Okay.